Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party's and the Socialist Party's candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to advocate and organize around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on in 2020. And today we have a guest, Anna Parakota, who we're going to talk about the war in Ukraine and everything around that. She's an ethnic Ukrainian who grew up in the Russian-speaking city of Donetsk in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. And she's now a researcher at the University of Lausanne, I hope I pronounced that right, Switzerland, where she studies the political imagination of Ukrainian and Russian national narratives. She's a founder of the Swiss-based Committee of Solidarity with the Ukrainian people. She works with the Russian opponents of the war, and she's a member of the Ukrainian Democratic Socialist Organization, Soltsiani Ruk, or Social Movement in English. Her articles and interviews have appeared in Democracy Now!, Green Left, Jacobin, New Politics, many other publications, and we'll put some links to some of those articles and interviews in the chat later on. And Hanna is part of a tour of Ukrainian and Russian socialists who are speaking in the United States between September 3rd and 14th, a tour sponsored by the Ukraine Solidarity Network. They'll be in Chicago, New York, and the San Francisco Bay Area in that time period. And the point of the tour is to amplify the voices of progressive Ukrainians and Russians who have experienced firsthand the ravages of Putin's invasion of Ukraine and his effort to silence anti-war and democratic opposition within Russia. And these voices are too often drowned out because mostly what we're hearing are the competing narratives of U.S. and Russian imperialism, and they dominate the commentary on the war. So we're really happy that Hanna agreed to be with us today to share perspectives on the war in Ukraine. And we're going to do this as an interview. And so the first question I want to ask Hanna is, Russian President Vladimir Putin has argued that Ukrainians like you don't exist. He has said the Ukrainian state is a fiction created by the Lenin and the godless Bolsheviks, a fiction being used by what he calls Anglo-American imperialism to attack Russia. So he says that Russia's invasion of Ukraine is defensive and only taking back what belongs to Russia. And your research is focused on the ideologies of both Ukrainian national identity and the Russian political establishment's view of Ukraine as really part of Russia. So can you talk about these conflicting national narratives, how they developed, over the years, particularly since independence in 1991 and then Putin coming to power in 2000? How much is Putin's invasion rooted in these ideological commitments as opposed to, traditional analyses of imperialism, which focus on geopolitical, economic, and security interests? So it's a long question, but I know you can hear it.
Very long question. Very complicated and very interesting. So, yeah, thanks a lot for giving me this possibility to speak, to discuss with you, to share my perspective. So I will maybe start from your last question. How much is Putin invasion rooted in this objective security interests of Russia, and how much of it is due to the, let's say, ideology of its ruling classes? So yeah, it will not be a short answer, I must say. So because the way we understand the reasons of this war, in my opinion, determines what we can propose as a solution to end this war. So this analysis has direct political outcomes. That's why I will use this possibility to develop it more in details. Let's not forget that until the day of invasion, 24th February of 2022, there was kind of disbelief and kind of skepticism in the media, in the general atmospheres, because many observers were saying that Putin was too smart to start a large scale war in Ukraine. That was what some experts in international politics were saying at the very moment when the Russian troops were actually gathering on the Ukrainian border. Nobody wanted to believe the war, the real war, would take place, because if Russia was an actor that was sharing some kind of universal state rationality, this full-scale invasion of Ukraine made no sense, because risks were obviously too high, the gains of this war was too uncertain, and also a limited war in Donbas that was already taking place for 9 years. It was doing its job already, because it prevented Ukraine from joining NATO or even from joining the EU for decades and decades to come. So Ukraine was kind of already paralyzed by this Russian limited hybrid war in the Donbas. So why go further? But once the full-scale invasion actually started, the experts started to search for this post-factum explanations. And those who were saying that it made no sense for Putin to start a war, suddenly they started to argue that that the external threat have been certainly so serious and was so heavy, weighted so heavy upon Russia, that Russia had no other choice than to invade Ukraine to actually protect itself. So they stick to the idea that Russia is kind of a rational actor, and they conclude that the extent of the Russian military aggression must have been proportional to the gravity of kind of an objective external threat to the Russian security. And of course, they concluded that this threat was emanating from the West, from NATO, of course. Otherwise, we cannot explain this event without actually destroying the basis of the whole theory. And well-known professors visibly prefer to ignore the reality and then to put their theory in question, especially when the theory is something that made them very well known, well paid, made them experts in international politics, etc. So these people who share consciously or unconsciously this kind of structural realist perspective also defend the fact that the invasion of Ukraine could have been avoided if NATO not been expanded. And this interpretation also leads to the conclusion with some important implications. So if we think that Russia started the war because the West kind of violated its zone of influence, it means that the war could be eventually ended if Russia's security concerns are considered and are satisfied. And, well, we can say already that this kind of logic, which is kind of widespread, it openly says that if your country is not a great power like Russia, like US, or like China, you have no right to sovereignty at all, and you are forever doomed to be a colony of somebody else. So do not even try to fight for your, I don't know, national liberation or human dignity. The world belongs to great powers, so just deal with it. But if we put aside these kind of moral issues and we assume that maybe eventually the key to peace in the world is to accept that the world must be divided into several great power zones of influence, that somehow this great power would recognize and would respect for some reason. Let's even forget the fact that this kind of architecture, world architecture, already led to two world wars. Like, let's forget about it. several questions arise when we think about Russia. First question is, what makes somebody think that the zone of influence of Russia stops in Ukraine or even in the post-Soviet space? Why not the whole Eastern and Central Europe? Why not a half of Germany is a legitimate zone of influence for Russia? And the second question, why do we think that keeping Ukraine outside of NATO would somehow calm Putin down? We think in this way because the underlying assumption behind that is that NATO is an objective, a real threat to the Russian physical security, or that the European Union is a threat to Russian economic security, for example. But we see here some important, something that doesn't actually match, because as you know, Finland and Sweden, they joined NATO recently. And as a result, the Russian border with NATO increased twice. Now it's huge. But what is interesting is that the Finnish foreign minister says that there is no Russian troops that have moved to the border with Finland. So Finland is in NATO, but no Russian troops like there. So, and if NATO was kind of an objective threat to Russia as a state, we can ask ourselves why there is no Russian troops on the border with Finland, and why there is even no official state propaganda about Finland, like framing Finland as a military threat, framing Finnish people as enemies, whatever. So visibly, it's not a big deal for Putin that Finland, having its huge border with Russia, is joining NATO, while Ukraine, which have never been an, even a candidate to NATO, and if it's not in the European Union, but Ukraine is perceived as a threat to, I don't know, to Russian, to the existence of Russia. So maybe the problem is not NATO. Maybe the problem is somewhere else. So that's why I consider this perspective, which frames, which talks about the economic, political, and also security concerns of Russia. This perspective is unable to explain the Russian war in Ukraine. And in order to understand it, I think we must make an effort and look inside this black box of the Russian domestic politics. We must, for example, consider at least two factors. Internal class contradictions and imperial ideology of the Russian ruling classes. And if we look carefully at Russia from a class perspective, not from geopolitical perspective, but from a class perspective, we will see that actually, first thing, Putin has turned Russia into one of the most unequal states in the world when 1% of the population owns 75% of the total wealth. I think in the United States, it's something about 46%, which is also huge, but 46, 75, there is a difference. And the more this inequality was growing in Russia, the more vulnerable the regime was feeling internally, and the more aggressive it was becoming externally, it was becoming towards its neighbors. And actually, maybe we forgot it already, but Putin was not always anti-West, anti-NATO. He was even in partnership with NATO in the beginning of 2000, and even organized the common military trainings, etc. But in 2011, he started to say that West was a threat, NATO was a threat. And what happened in 2011 is that a lot of Russians, like ordinary Russians, went to the streets to protest against the Putin's democratic decision, to protest against authoritarianism, against police violence, against inequality. So when Russian elites had this fear that they will lose power, they start to generate this anti-Western discourse in order actually to increase their political legitimacy and to preserve the power inside Russia, because of course it becomes essential to eliminate all these democratization tendencies in the neighborhood, especially in Ukraine. And that's why the aggression towards post-Soviet democratizing countries increased. So Putin invaded a part of Ukraine in 2014 after the popular revolution in Ukraine. And then he also sent his army to crush the revolutions in Belarus, in Kazakhstan, the revolutions that there was no question about, like NATO, Western influence whatsoever. These were mostly social revolutions about social concerns. So if we adopt this class perspective, this war, we can see that this war was not a response to some objective threat to the Russian society. It was not a response to some external threat that was a result of tensions between the interests of states. But we can analyze it as a response to a subjective threat to Russian political and economic elites. And the threat resulted from the tension not between states, but between the classes inside of the Russian state itself. Just to continue on this analyze, I think I consider that international relations are like socially constructed, and it's not just some impersonal state that decides what the international relations will look like. But we have some very concrete individuals in power, and they determine the international policy of their states. And they do it on the basis of their own representations of themselves, representations of the world. And these representations are shaped historically. And for me, that means that in order to understand this Russian war against Ukraine, it is very important to make sense of the ideology that actually determines the worldview of the Russian political establishment. And as you said in your question, yes, Putin believes that Ukrainians like me and Ukrainians in general do not exist. And he actually, in his speeches, he insists that Russians and Ukrainians are the same people, the same nation. And he's actively defending this thesis on every possible occasion. He even published a long article, kind of a pseudo-scientific article dedicated entirely to this idea. And we can summarize his view about Ukraine in 3 points. For Putin, Ukraine as a distinct state, as a culture, it is an artificial invention. And it was invented by some internal or external enemies of Russia that wanted to destroy Russia, destroy the Russian nation. That could be Polish, I don't know, nationalists, Austro-Hungarian intellectuals, it could be Bolsheviks, it could be Nazi Germans. So it could be different enemies of Russia who were throughout of history engaged into nourishing the imperialism of Ukraine in order to destroy Russia. Because in this worldview of Putin, if Ukraine is separated from Russia, it becomes a base for these enemy forces enemy forces of the West that dream to contain Russia, to prevent actually it from gaining its place in the world. So these enemies of the West take Ukraine, transform it into an enemy of Russia. And that's why independent Ukraine outside the influence of Russia becomes kind of automatically a threat to the very survival of the Russian state. And this idea, it's not just, a product of personal imagination of Putin. It's not just his own crazy ideas. These are historically constituted like collective imagination, quite a widespread. And these kind of ideas, they determine the way how the Russian ruling circles, how the Russian intellectuals view Ukraine, how they see Ukraine. And this kind of ideology was shaped mainly in the 19th and 20th century. That's why it's so important to know the history of the Russian Empire and the history of relations between Russia and Ukraine in order to understand the logic behind of the Russian attitude towards Ukraine. So for me, that means that if in this kind of ideology, Ukrainians must become Russians or they must disappear. Because in this worldview, the fate of Russia is at stake. To turn Ukrainians into Russia is perceived by the Russian political class as a necessary condition for the ontological security of the Russian state. So Putin and the Russian political class started this war following the logic of the ontological security and not the logic of some physical security. It has nothing to do with NATO threat whatsoever, but it has everything to do with these ideological structures that actually determine the worldview of Russian political elites.
Okay, it was a complicated question and a detailed answer. And I hope people were taking notes or they go back and listen again, because that was deep. And I think it had a lot to say. One of the things you mentioned was the social revolution in 2014 in Ukraine, the Maidan revolution. And Putin and the Kremlin, their propaganda is that it was a U.S. organized Nazi coup and resulted in a Nazi state in Ukraine that started discriminating against ethnic Russians, banned the Russian language, and even engaged in genocide against ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. So you're from, the Russian speaking part of Ukraine in the Donbass. You know, give us your perspective on those claims by Russia.
Well, about the fact that about this perception that the revolution, the Maidan revolution, was a Nazi coup organized by U.S., when the claims are as absurd, it is quite difficult to know where to start actually to explain why it is not the case. I think I already partly explained why Putin and the Kremlin have an interest in kind of a demonization of the revolution in the neighboring countries and especially in Ukraine. In Ukraine, like Ukraine is a country with which ordinary Russians have a lot of cultural proximity. Many people have family in Ukraine, friends there. Their languages are quite connected and similar and understandable. Cultures are also quite linked to one to another. So if Ukraine actually succeeds in building a democratic state, economically, and a state that functions well in economic terms, of course, it risks awakening some dangerous ideas among Russians, Exactly, because Ukraine is so similar to Russia, and Ukrainians are so similar to Russians in many ways. So the Russians who will see Ukrainians who actually live better after the revolution, but they may ask themselves if Ukrainians are capable, to build a democratic state, if Ukrainians do not need a repressive authoritarian leader to actually live normally, why do we Russians need these kind of things? And I do not know if I need to persuade anybody that it was not a Nazi coup. I mean, if you have some sense of reality, and if you do not see the world through the lenses of Russia Today channel, probably you are aware that in Ukraine we don't have a extreme right government, and during the Maidan uprising, out of 15,000 self-defense activists on Maidan, people who were actually defending this place against the police, only 500 were in some way affiliated with the so-called right sector, which is an extreme right-wing group. And as all the popular revolutions, of course, the revolution of Maidan was a huge movement, and most of the people were not affiliated with any political force, left or right. Most of them came to the streets to protest, maybe first time in their lives. And people came out massively to the streets for one reason. When the police had violently beaten 100 of young, mostly liberal activists who were protesting against the undemocratic decision of the president, who rejected an economic agreement with Europe and who decided to turn to Russia, Russia, who was exercising an enormous pressure on Ukraine in order to prevent it from joining the European institutions or any other international organization that was not created by Russia. So that's the moment when most of the people came to the streets. They were protesting against the police violence, actually. So, and also the revolution was triggered. The beginning of the revolution was triggered by this association agreement with Ukraine, which was with the European Union that Yanukovych, the former the president, rejected. And this association agreement with Ukraine was presented by the European Union as a project that was aiming to improve the prosperity, the stability in the whole region, in the whole something which theoretically should also benefit Russia. And European officials in 2014 were doing everything actually to address what they believed were Russian concerns about the negative economic and security implications of this association. And they wanted to make it clear that the association agreement is actually intended to replace any prospect of Ukraine joining the EU, and there was no geopolitical ambitions attached to it, as, for example, NATO membership was out of question. And so the aim of these agreements, as presented by the European Union, was to promote reforms in Ukraine, to promote democracy, the rule of law, etc. But what European officials don't seem to understand is that it is exactly the rule of law, democracy, and economic prosperity in Ukraine that pose a real threat to the Russian political elites. And here I will emphasize once again the role of identities, of worldviews, of perceptions in international politics. Because as you remember, in 2014, the demonstrators used the European flag in Ukraine as a symbol of their choice in favor of democracy, in favor of the rule of law, being associated with the European development model. Of course, it is not entirely true. Like, the European Union is not a democratic paradise, but for Ukrainians, it is a symbol of something better, a democratic future. So, but when Putin was looking at these events through the prism of his Russian nationalism perspective, he saw these events as something that actually reinforced his convictions, his worldview. He saw these events as something where the West, the evil West, activated the Ukrainian nationalists. The West wanted to alienate Ukraine, and he did it to prevent Russia from taking its place, taking the place of a great power, taking the place it actually deserves. So, and another thing that you pointed about this kind of narrative that it was a Nazi coup, that Ukrainians are portrayed as Nazis by the Russian propaganda, and also in general this myth about neo-Nazi right-wing forces being particularly strong in Ukraine, stronger than in any other country. This is something interesting to explore, because often Western audience takes these claims as something that has to do with reality of Ukraine. But for me, these claims about Nazis in Ukraine, it has more to do with the Russian national narrative, because the term fascism in Russia is associated with the Nazi Germany, and it kind of describes the term fascism, describes an enemy of the Russian nation, and the struggle against fascists in this kind of narrative is nothing other than a struggle for the survival of Russia against the fascist enemy. So fascism in public discourse is not understood as a political system or as a particular ideology. It is understood as an expression of the will of the enemy to destroy Russia. So fascist, enemy, Russophobic, these are kind of interchangeable words. These are synonyms for most of the Russians. And in this logic, anyone who speaks out against what Russia is doing would be a fascist. And the national narrative built around this cult of victory against fascism during the Second World War allows actually to present all the actions of Russia on the international stage, to present it as an expression of a perpetual war against fascism. And the fact that the Kremlin presents the 2014 revolution in Ukraine as a fascist coup and presents the current Ukrainian government as fascists and neo-Nazis, it has everything to do with this discursive framework that actually dominates the narrative in Putin's Russia, because there is this myth of eternal struggle against fascism, and the war of 2022 would be kind of a continuation of this great patriotic war of 1941-1945. The Ukrainian government, the neo-Nazis, the Nazis, the fascists, are like kind of presented as the complete enemies. So this war is kind of inscribed in this frame of national history. Russia is engaged in an eternal battle against the enemy, enemy coming from the West, and it is on the Ukrainian soil that it is waging its fight for existence, for the survival. And the fact that, for example, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky is a Russian-speaking Jew who explicitly opposed ethno-nationalism in his election campaign, but it doesn't prevent Russian propaganda from calling him a fascist or a Nazi, because these terms simply serve to dehumanize the other, to make him, to describe him as an enemy to be destroyed by any means.
You're a Ukrainian that grew up in the Russian-speaking city of Donetsk in the Donbas region. And one of the narratives we often hear from Russia is that the Donbas, the people in the Donbas, are engaged in their own national liberation struggle from Ukrainian oppression. And so you grew up there, you know people there. What's your sense of the attitudes of the people in Ukraine, in the Donbas, toward Ukraine or separatism, and both, you know, among the popular classes, but also the role of the oligarchs in this whole separatism thing?
In order to understand what we speak about when we speak about the Donbas, because it's not a self-evident entity, it's not an administrative district which is called the Donbas, it doesn't exist. It is kind of a word that was politically instrumentalized to describe an entity that actually doesn't exist as a homogeneous entity. It's not a historical region. It's an economic region. It's an economic region that was created mostly in the beginning of the 20th century. It was this region, which was a kind of poorly populated region, started to be populated only from this late 19th century. And the majority of the population living in the Donbas settled in this area quite recently, because the biggest wave of migration to the Donbas started after the Second World War. And these people were coming from all over the Soviet Union, searching for jobs, because it was an industrial region, so there was a lot of jobs in coal mining. At the time, it was one of the most prestigious and well-paid industries in the whole Soviet Union. So it was a very wealthy region at that time, very well developed comparing to other regions of Ukraine. But during the 1980s, during the perestroika, we have this accumulation of economic deficiencies in the Soviet economy. And of course, there was a threat for this population to lose this privileged status that they had, and the fact that the economy was in decline, locals started to support the idea of Ukrainian independence. It was one of the most Russified regions because of this structural inequality. In Ukraine, most of the people, when they were living in the urban areas in big cities, there was an obligation to speak Russian because speak Ukrainian was seen as a stigma, as a social stigma. You cannot have a good job you cannot be perceived as somebody serious and as somebody modern if you speak Ukrainian. So most of the people in the Donbas were speaking Russian because they were living in the big cities. But despite the fact that they were speaking Russian, they supported the idea of the Ukrainian independence because they were hoping that the Donbas would become the dominant region in the economy and in the politics of independent Ukraine. But of course, as we know, when the Soviet Union fell, all the republics, they fell prey to the wild capitalism. The population everywhere lost the few social privileges they have. They even lost the symbolic privileges. And because before that, the people in the Donbas, they were thinking they were in the vanguard of the Soviet Union, because they were the workers, they were the coal miners, etc. So they found themselves in a very desperate position from all the points of view, from the economic point of view, of course, but also from the point of view of their symbolic privilege that was lost after the fall of the Soviet Union. The civil society was quite weak in the Donbas, and the population started, the older population started to be nostalgic for this glory of the Soviet past, started to be nostalgic for the period when they had not only jobs, but also this symbolic prestige of being a worker. And this situation was kind of a fertile ground for local mafia, who, of course, they took complete control of the economy, of the local politics, of media, Donbas being such a wealthy region, such a region full of resources, they gained so much power in this region, that they wanted to take over the political power in the whole of Ukraine. So they kind of started a struggle for the power in Kyiv. And to win this struggle, they started to persuade the local population that the Donbas kind of feeds the whole Ukraine, that the Donbas was exploited by the Western Ukrainians, despite the fact that Western Ukraine were much poorer than the Donbas. And even in the years of extreme crisis, wages in the Donbas were twice as high as they were in the other parts of Ukraine. President Yanukovych, the president that was expelled from Ukraine, that went to Russia after the revolution of Maidan, he actually emerged from this mafia, from the mafia in the Donbas. He created his clan with some allied oligarchs, they were exploiting this resentment in the population. They started to demonize everything Ukrainian, and it was actually a mean to divide and rule, to this kind of complex identities of local population that were quite blurred, quite unfixed. Identities were an easy prey for this kind of manipulation, for political instrumentalization. So power struggle, the struggle for power of this Donbas mafia, resulted in a situation where the Donbas became more and more isolated from the rest of the country, politically, economically, culturally, and this division was manipulated for electoral purposes a lot. And when Yanukovych was elected, so this Donbas mafia began actually running the country, running the whole of Ukraine. And when the Maidan uprising started, of course, it has put their rule under threat. And in response to that threat, Yanukovych and the Donbas mafia and his clan, they provided the resources for the separatist movement in the Donbas, because they were hoping that at least maybe they will not preserve the power in Kyiv, but at least they will preserve the power in the Donbas where they came from. But of course, even if in the Donbas the population had this sense of local exceptionalism, the separatist project was in didn't exist. The separatist desire were very marginal, and there was no evidence of real, genuine support for an armed uprising or for creating a separate state or for joining Russia. Most of the population were quite passive, I can say. And I know like how that did it happen in 2014 in the Donbas. Most of the population were regarding it as a power struggle in which they must not participate. And in this on this background of this general passivity and kind of ideological disorientation, a Russian FSB officer, Igor Strelkov-Girkin, who is now in prison in Russia, who's a right-wing Russian nationalist, he was provided with some important resources, with arms, with people, and he came to Donetsk, he came to Donbas, and he took control of some local institutions, and he started to ask Moscow to send volunteers to sustain this kind of armed rebellion of the Donbas nation that doesn't exist. So all this to say that, of course, there were some baseline factors that facilitated this crisis, but these factors were not enough in themselves to explain the outbreak of war. These existing tensions were manipulated already for a long time by local elites, but it's very unlikely that the war in Donbas would have happened without the direct Russian military intervention. And Igor Girkin Strelkov actually said very explicitly he was the one who started the war in Donbas, and he was actually proud of it when he was saying it. Nobody in the local population wanted war and wanted a separate state. People were just disoriented and quite passive. So, yeah, and one of the key factors, of course, was the support given by the oligarchs who tried to play both sides until they were actually replaced by the Kremlin puppets. And now, unfortunately, like the region I came from, like after the 2014, before the 2014, it was a wealthy region, a developing region. It became then a zone of corruption, of total impunity, of violence, of injustice, of poverty, of repression, physical abuse, everything. And now, just physically, these cities, these towns that I know very well because I spent my childhood there, they are just bombed to the ground. They just doesn't exist anymore. And one of the most populated, one of the most wealthiest urban region of Ukraine is now totally physically destroyed by the Russian military intervention.
So just to clean up a couple of the parts of that question, is Russian language banned in Ukraine? That's one thing we hear often.
Yeah, I know where does this myth came from. After the President Yanukovych left Ukraine after the Maidan Revolution, there was Ukrainian parliament tried to abolish a law about languages in Ukraine. This was a law which was very criticized in Ukraine. the law that intended to protect minority languages, but actually was protected only one minority language, and it was the Russian language. No other languages were protected, and this law was explicitly made to serve the Russian interests, and nobody even hid at this fact. So, and of course, Ukrainians know what this minority language law actually means. So this the Ukrainian parliament wanted to abolish it. And it was a very bad timing, because it was the situation of a total political crisis, of a power vacuum, a power, maybe power collapse. And actually, the president of Ukraine never ratified this decision of the Ukrainian parliament. So this law was abolished only in 2019 in order to say explicitly that the state, the official language of Ukraine is Ukrainian, but we give all the guarantees to all the other languages to develop, to be protected, etc. So, of course, in the Ukrainian laws, there are no intention to ban Russian language in Ukraine. And most of the people, even after the revolution of 2014, continue to use Russian, not only in their private life, but also in their professional life, in the media, etc., etc. It was not banned. It was we need to understand this move if we know the oppression that the Ukrainian language was subjected to during the years and years and decades, how the Russian language was explicitly favored in order to replace a Ukrainian language. The language issue, I cannot say it is complicated in Ukraine. The language issue can be easily resolved in Ukraine because most of the people are bilingual. They speak both Ukrainian and Russian, like me, for example, and like most of the people I know, they speak both of them. Why this issue is so politicized? It's because Russia used this its language, the language issue, as a weapon, of domination, as a weapon of disinformation. That's why the Russian using the Russian language in Ukraine becomes more and more problematic for Ukrainians, because they do not want to be associated in any way with the state that actually invaded them and that have an explicit intention to destroy their state, destroy their culture, to destroy their language. So there is no ban on the Russian language in Ukraine, but there are more and more Ukrainians that do not want to speak Russian because of the way how Russia weaponized the language issue.
Okay, so before we get to some of the questions in the chat, just why don't you wrap up and, you know, tell people what the Ukrainian left is asking of the Western left in terms of solidarity. What should the Western left be doing to support your struggle for independence, peace, democracy, social justice?
The position of independent unions, of left organizations in Ukraine, of my organization, which is called Socialny Rukh, the position is the following one. On one side, we ask to increase military, financial, and diplomatic support for Ukrainian state, because the Ukrainian state now functions as a state that protects our population from being invaded by the force of the foreign occupation. But it doesn't mean that we remain uncritical for what our state is doing in terms of social justice, for example. Like, for us, it is clear that Ukraine must be independent, and in order to develop and in order to be independent, we must support our state and our army. And we consider that only the complete withdrawal of the occupying forces, of the occupying Russian troops, that the troops that murder civilians, that rape women, that bomb the residential areas, only the complete withdrawal of these Russian troops from all the Ukrainian territory is a precondition for a sustainable peace, but also for the development of the Ukrainian society, for the social justice, for the political freedom, etc. We cannot have a political freedom and a social justice under the occupation. And this is something I have a feeling that this is something most of the people tend to forget when they are living in the Western countries. But also, as leftists, we don't want that this war could be used to favor the oligarchs, to favor the corporations at the expense of the people. These are the ordinary Ukrainians, Ukrainian workers who are now defending the Ukrainian state and the Ukrainian society. And we consider that the decision of what Ukraine must look like must belong to the people. So that's why the left support, the support of the left in the US, in Europe, but also in other countries, in the countries that know what it means to be under the occupation and under the colonial influence. We consider that the left support is crucial for us, because if leftists in the world support us, the Ukrainian leftists could become stronger, and we can make everything to actually help Ukraine to become truly democratic, pluralistic, inclusive, social-oriented state. So Ukrainians, of course, do not want to be seen just as silent victims of war who expect some kind of charity. Ukrainians are resisting, and this is a self-organizing society. And of course, what other leftists in other countries could do is to amplify the voices of Ukrainians and to build the links with the forces of social transformation, with Ukrainian civic organizations, with trade unions, but also with Russian progressive anti-war organization, anti-war personalities, with anti-colonial activists from the Russian Federation, with feminists. Of course, you can do a lot. You can raise money for their initiatives. You can participate in international campaign, for example, the campaign for the cancellation of the Ukrainians' debt, and the campaign in support of Russian anti-war activists who are now imprisoned by Putin, etc. And of course, you can incite your government, Western government, to be to know what is their responsibility, the responsibility of most of the Western governments is that they continue to buy Russian oil and gas, and they do not want to block the assets of Putin's oligarchs. So ask them at least to confiscate the assets of Putin's oligarchs and to use this money for the reconstruction of Ukraine. So I think there is a lot of possibilities to help Ukrainians and to help also Russian anti-war activists. You just need to stay in solidarity with the oppressed and against the oppressors, and to try to hear and try to consider the voice of those who experience this war and who come from Ukraine and come from Russia.
Okay, let's take some questions. You can hang out for a while longer, Anna, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. We normally go an hour, but we got a lot of questions, so let's get some of them up on the screen. Vicky Corden asks, it concerns me Putin's insatiable appetite for power. It could cause the war to spread and complicate things for the rest of the world. So what's your comment on that?
About his appetite for power. Well, we cannot, we don't know what is inside of Putin's head, and is it really an appetite for power or something else which is driving his action. But one of the things is that, to consider that, yes, there is a possibility that this war could spread and could and Russia could possibly not stop on Ukraine, but to go further. Because one of the things that I wanted to explain is that for an autocratic imperial state like Russia, any neighbor that that wants to be a democratic state, that wants to be that is considered as a state which is democratic and has a border with Russia will be automatically considered as a potential threat. So this invasion can go further and further, because one of the logic of the imperial expansion is to protect your borders by invading by invading the states who are a represented potential democratic state for your autocratic model. And I, for example, I suggest to read works of Jeremy Snyder, who is taking about this imperial logic of expansion. That's why I consider that there is a threat that Putin, if he is not stopped in Ukraine, could continue to invade other countries that he considers to be a threat for his system.
Michael LeBron, why aren't you talking about shale gas? Russia is a petrol state, little different from Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Venezuela, et cetera. All have morally bankrupt government regimes. So yeah, there's a lot of shale gas in, I guess, in the Azov Sea and in Donbass. So I guess the question is, you know, isn't that what's motivating Russia to get more shale gas?
No, I don't think so. They have enough gas. I think we need, even if we, of course, we tend to have a Marxist perspective, a materialist perspective on history, on the world politics, but I think it is a wrong take here. Russia is not motivated by any economic interests in what they are doing in Ukraine. And I actually tried to answer why Ukraine, like, it is not an economic issue. To control Ukraine is actually a mean to preserve the power inside of Russia itself. And like the Donbas, especially after the destructions made by the Russian army in this region, it will not be rebuilt any soon. The losses that the Russian army inflicted to the Russian state are much, much bigger than any potential gain from this war. I think we need to have we need to distance ourselves from this thinking that all the wars are waged for some kind of economic natural resources. It's not really the case here. There is a political logic behind it. But one of the things is that, yes, of course, the fact that the Russian economy is based on the exploitation of natural resources like gas and oil, it has a huge implications on the political model that the Russia developed, because actually Russian political elites gain their wealth solely by exploiting the natural resources, by extracting gas and oil and selling it to the mostly Western powers who base their economic growth on the fossil fuels. And I think this is an unlimited growth that will continue because they could buy this cheap Russian gas and oil, cheap Saudi Arabian gas and oil. And the fact that the Russian elite's power and wealth is dependent only on these, on the pipelines that allow them to actually not consider the interests of the population, because the Russian political elites are not dependent on the taxpayers or something. Their wealth is not dependent on any taxes and on any political, on the population in general. That's why I think the dream of the Russian political elite, the Russia they dream about, is the Russia where there is a huge pipeline, they can continue to sell gas and oil, but they don't need any population. Russia without Russians is a dream country for Putin and his clan. They do not need a population at all. Maybe a few thousand people to take care of the pipeline, but no more than that. That's why states who has this type of economy tend to be very undemocratic and authoritarian states. And this also gives us an idea about the fact that our consumption of fossil fuels, how our economies are entirely based on the fossil fuels. This, we also have a huge responsibility about what is happening in Russia and what Russia is doing, what Saudi Arabia is doing, what all these petrol states are actually doing, what kind of dictatorship do they develop inside their country, what kind of wars they're waging against their neighbors. We have a huge responsibility in it because we don't put into question our model of energy consumption.
Nada Barca, is it true that Russia has an extensive pension system that many people rely on that may be a source of a lot of Putin's support? Thank you for your perspectives.
That's a part of the answer I gave. The fact that all the Russian wealth comes from gas and oil that they're selling to the other countries. Of course, this petrol rent can be distributed among the population. So that's why pension people who rely on pension, people who are in the public service, they tend to support the status quo, to support Putin, because their wealth is directly tied to the model of economy that Putin has created.
Lomboy Wilson, how can leftists support Zelensky, who has outlawed his opposition, whose government has a kill list with American names on it? Hell no.
I don't. How can leftists support Zelensky, who outlawed his opposition? It's a big question. There is a lot of things to say, but Zelensky, what is an opposition in Ukraine? Because there is, for example, all this mythology about left parties being banned in Ukraine. Well, this is not true. And left organizations are like my organization and a few other ones we're existing in Ukraine, we're not hiding, we're doing some public politics, and actually some parties that call themselves, for example, socialists, they were banned, not because they were socialist. Of course, they were not socialist. They were a property of some oligarchs. They were banned because these were parties who were explicitly supporting the Russian invasion, and most of these people actually left Ukraine just before the Russian invasion to go to Russia, and who were paid directly by Russia for the for the destabilization inside of Ukraine. And these are the proven facts. So when we think about opposition, maybe we think about, you know, some state like United States, or maybe some Western countries where political opposition is actually a political issue. But in Ukraine, in political opposition, you have people who are like agents of a state which invades you. So this is not a political opposition. These are clearly like the agents of the occupying forces. I don't know about a kill list with American names on it. Maybe I will read something about it. Why leftists support Zelensky? We don't support Zelensky as a politician. We don't support his economic policies. We don't consider that he is an authoritarian right-wing dictator. It's not at all the case. He was elected democratically. He didn't even show some specific political ambitions before. So we treat him as a tool, and everybody in Ukraine, I think, there is not a lot of people who actually glorify Zelensky or something like that. Most of the people see him as a person who, by the circumstances, just became a president in Ukraine and became a president of a country that was invaded by Russia. And he's playing his democratic, not democratic, diplomatic role quite well as the president of a country that is in struggle against the foreign occupation. So as leftists, we support the government because we want our country not to be occupied by the Russian army. But once it is liberated, of course, Zelensky is not our ally. He's our political, I would not say enemy, but yes, we are politically in opposition to the government of Zelensky, and we can actually allow ourselves to be in opposition even in the times of war. We can criticize the decision of the Ukrainian government in terms of economic and social policies. We can even try to organize people to defend their rights in the times of war. And yeah, so don't forget that there is a war in Ukraine, like there, and the war, it means that it is not a normal situation where can you speak about normal politics, about opposition, about, no, there is like missiles falling on the Ukrainian cities every day, and people dying every day by hundreds and thousands. So of course we support Zelensky because he is one of the people who is defending the existence of Ukraine as a state, but we do not support him as a politician regarding the internal Ukrainian issues. I don't hear you. I don't know why.
Oh, I got okay. I was muted somehow. The kill list is a list that a nonprofit organization in Ukraine has of pro-Russian propagandists all over the world, including Ukraine, some Americans. But it's not like they're sending out assassins. There was one person on the kill list early on, got murdered, but not by this nonprofit organization. But the pro-Russian propagandists, you know, they say everybody that's, not everybody, but a lot of people that are pushing Putin's line are on the so-called kill list, which is a way of demonizing Ukraine. It's it's not a real fact, but it's being used.
Okay, thanks. I will read the something about it, because maybe it will be the question I will be asked in when I will be in the United States. So I need to know more about the things.
Well, I know we have more questions, but the guy behind the curtain may be saying it should be time to wrap up, unless another question pops up. No, that's now my banner's up there. So, Hanna, I really appreciate you coming on. We could go on for much longer, but we try to keep these so they're not so long that people will actually sit down and listen and watch. As I said earlier, Hanna's going to be in the United States from September 3rd to 14th on a tour with Ukrainian and Russian socialists against Russia's war in Ukraine. They'll be speaking in Chicago on Labor Day weekend and then at the University of Loyola or Loyola University on a Tuesday after Labor Day. They'll be in New York on Saturday, September 9th at the LGBT Center in Manhattan, and then out at UC Berkeley in the San Francisco Bay Area on September 13th. And, you know, we'll be doing media. So, you know, the event out of New York City will be, you know, broadcast online. If you can't make it or even watch it live, it'll be up online, so you can catch that one. And once again, Hanna, we put a bunch of Hanna's articles, maybe five of them, that address some of the questions we were talking about. And I don't know how Hanna does it. I mean, English is like her fourth language after Russian, Ukrainian, maybe Serjak and French. And then there's English. So, she speaks English probably better than a lot of us do. So once again, you know, thanks for coming on. Next week, I will be at Socialism 2023 in Chicago, where the first event of this tour is a panel that Hanna will be on, along with Ilya Budrakis, who was on the podcast last week, and Dennis Bondar, who has been on a podcast we had back in January. So while I'm there, I will grab somebody who's interesting to come on the podcast on Saturday. Don't know who that is yet, but it'll be a surprise. And then the weekend after, or the Saturday after that, we'll have back Natalie Monterez and Bill Berry. Natalie is the worker at the Amazon hub in Staten Island, where they got the vote for the union, but they haven't got negotiations. And, oh, Natalie's in the chat. So she'll be on September 9th. A lot of safety and health issues and abuse by supervisors. They sure need a union there. So that's what we're going to talk about on September 9th. So once again, thanks everybody for being here. Have a good week, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.